This is an interview with Joseph Grunfest for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby. Today's date is June 20th, 2013, and our interview is taking place at the Stanford Law School, Palo Alto, California. Professor Grunfest, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Bob, and good morning.
So I find it's generally useful to start with early life and education. Growing up, were you interested in economics and law?
Growing up, I was interested in everything other than economics and law, you know, whether baseball, or I didn't get interested in economics and law really till college, and law not until really after college.
So, and you did your undergrad work at Yale?
Undergrad at Yale and the London School of Economics.
Okay. Where did you sort of encounter the economics for the first time?
It was first year at Yale.
Okay.
I entered Yale thinking that I'd take a shot at math, theoretical mathematics, that kind of stuff. And, in the first, week or two, you're in a seminar at Yale with real mathematicians, I quickly learned that if I was good at math, I wasn't great at math. I may have been really good, but I wasn't truly great.
Mm-hmm.
And my, you'd had homework assignments, you have to, prove theorems, and it would take me a bit longer to prove the theorem than the best kids in the class, mm-hmm. and my theorem would be a few lines longer than the best kids in the class. And in math, you're either at the absolute very top or you're going to starve.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured I better find something else, all right? Economics worked well for me. I really enjoyed it. It had that mathematical orientation, so I could, apply the mathematical approach. It was just filled with very interesting problems and challenges, so I really took to it.
And then you pursued that further at the London School of Economics?
I did a junior year abroad
at
the London School of Economics, and, great thanks to the training that I had at Yale, because, I showed up there and they had an undergraduate program, and I had a terrific advisor, and I explained to them that, all the stuff you want to teach me, I already know. And my advisor, great guy, said, all right, hot shot. We're going to put you in the master's program, all right, for mathematical economics and econometrics.
Mm-hmm.
And he just basically says, I dare you, all right, to do this program.
Uh-huh.
So did the program. It was great. The teachers, again, were absolutely fantastic. I took the exams. I got first-place distinctions. It was
mm-hmm.
really wild. They refused to give me the degree because I hadn't finished my bachelor's. And the requirement for getting the master's, all right, was you had to have a bachelor's degree before they would give you the master's.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you're going to make me go back to New Haven, finish my bachelor's degree, and then come back here, and they said, look, yeah, you go back, you finish your bachelor's, you come here, we'll give you exactly the same exams again, all right, and then we'll can give you the master's, but we can't do it out of sequence. And I said, oh, come on. And so I never got the degree. I took the exams, uh-huh. And so I can't claim to have the master's degree, even though I completed the program. I just did it out of sequence.
That's wild.
Rules are rules. Ask the SEC.
Did anything about that push you towards? You ended up in law school after that. So
mm-hmm.
was there anything? Was there anything in your?
No, I tell you what pushed me to law school.
Okay.
After college, I got a job at the Rand Corporation,
mm-hmm.
and again, just I've been fantastically lucky with my educational experience and with the training that I've
mm-hmm.
received. And at Rand, working on a range of projects. And, typically we would do these consulting projects, and all of the stuff that we did wound up being shipped to Washington on the domestic side, and it would always be reviewed by lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyers would make the decisions about how our research was going to be implemented.
Okay.
And 6 months into my Rand experience, I realized that, to me, it looked like lawyers were running the world. Economists would whisper in lawyers' ears, and lawyers would then make the decision. And my reaction was, damn it, if I'm going to whisper in somebody else's ear and have them make the decision, I'm going to make the decisions too. Mm-hmm. So what's so hard about going to law school?
Sure.
So I decided to do the joint JD PhD mm-hmm. program here at Stanford. And I got interested in law really only when I saw what the relationship okay. was between economics and lawyers in the policymaking process.
And that was an established program already, the joint JD and PhD?
Yeah, here okay. at Stanford, you know, even a century ago, mm-hmm. all right, you know, in the dark ages, the university was very good about joint PhD programs. And today, you know, here being multidisciplinary mm-hmm. is really one of the differentiating factors of this university.
Okay. What did you focus on, I guess, in both degrees in when you were here in law school / grad school?
Well, you know, again, you know, in law school, there are a large number of courses that had a very strong economic content, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's, you know, Bill Baxter teaching antitrust, you know, or the way Charlie Myers taught property. It was really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it was, in a certain sense, very early on in the law and economics movement.
Sure.
You know, so we're talking 1974, 75, a bazillion years ago. Mm-hmm. It was really just great. Okay. The law school was extraordinarily supportive of me doing work in the econ department. The econ department was very supportive mm-hmm. of me, you know, doing work in the law school. You know, and on the econ side, I focused on areas like, you know, finance, microeconomics, organization theory, game theory, stuff along those lines. So it was very complementary, mm-hmm. both areas of study.
Okay. And so when you came out, what did you think that you would be doing when you came out of both, I guess, both programs?
Oh, the main thing that I thought that I'd be doing would be following my wife.
Okay.
All right. You know, came out of law school, you know, got married the weekend after taking the bar. Mm-hmm. We loaded up everything that we owned into Carol's Volkswagen Rabbit. We drove cross-country in about 3.5 days. That was our honeymoon. We figured that if we were talking to each other, all right, at the end of that road trip, the relationship might last. Mm-hmm. So far, so good. I had a fellowship at the Brookings Institution,
okay.
Where I continued to do some economic research and the like. And, you know, we didn't really have a strong plan. You know, we didn't know whether we were going to stay on the East Coast, whether we were going to come back to mm-hmm. California. It turned out Carol wanted to stay on the East Coast. She had some terrific opportunities.
Okay.
And I said, great. Let me try to find a job.
Uh-huh.
And had a bunch of friends who were working at Wilmer, mm-hmm. You know, then Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering.
Mm-hmm.
And went over, interviewed, and they said, yeah, we got some work for you. And I said, great, let me help out.
And did you cover sort of the range of legal topics at Wilmer, or did you focus on?
No, I got it. Wilmer, again, was an absolutely spectacular learning experience because at the time, they trained lawyers in a way that was not specialized.
Mm-hmm.
I would be doing everything under the sun.
Okay.
There was a day where I'd be working on a major international antitrust investigation with Don Turner.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I in discovery, and we had to work out litigation strategy. And then I was helping write a Supreme Court brief, you know, for another one of the partners.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a trip and fall case for a elderly woman who used to be a secretary to mm-hmm. Colonel Wilmer, the original one of the founders of the firm. And it was my job to prosecute that case. And I learned all about trip and fall law in D.C. and we got a very, very nice payment out of a Chinese restaurant where this not-so-young lady happened to trip and fall on her way out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. I discovered about underground vaults and mm-hmm. Did some very interesting discovery and couldn't have been better.
Okay.
Great training experience because it was so eclectic.
Uh-huh. How did you go from there to the Council of Economic Advisors?
Basically, I got a phone call.
Okay.
And, you know, the phone call said, we're looking for somebody who's a lawyer and an economist. We have, you know, some big issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then the problem was the S&L crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we also need to figure out how to handle this new takeover activity,
sure.
which was then very new in mm-hmm. the world. I mean, this was before poison pills,
mm-hmm.
okay? It was a bazillion years ago, and the law was nowhere near as evolved as it is today. They said, you know, we heard that you understand all of this stuff
mm-hmm.
and that you're being reasonably well-trained, all right, at Wilmer, and you've got this PhD. You know, I never got the PhD, let me be clear about that, but you've got all this advanced economics training. Come on over. So I come on over and, you know, sit down, have a great conversation, but there's a problem. And that's, I'm a registered Democrat, all right, and this is the Reagan White House.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of say, well, you know, you're a little unusual for a Democrat because you actually believe that markets can work. And I said, yeah, you know, I am, you know, an economically rational Democrat, all right? You know, sometimes I say a free market Democrat, but I think that you say free market today, people think that means unregulated,
mm-hmm.
which is certainly not what I believe.
Sure.
But they sort of said, well, gee, you know, why are you a Democrat then? I said, well, and I remember this conversation with the people at the Office of White House Personnel, because I really think your social policies are misguided,
mm-hmm.
all right? And, you know, that was at a time when AIDS was a major issue, and I thought the government's, the Reagan administration's policy on AIDS was profoundly harmful. And there were a whole set of issues on which I just
mm-hmm.
we were never going to see eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you know, what did they think about gay rights, you know? And again, we're going back 30 years here. So there were a whole set of social policy issues
mm-hmm.
in which I just said, you know, guys, I don't agree. But when it comes to figuring out how to deal with the S&L industry, deal with takeovers, we were right on board. So I jokingly say that I'm the guy that invented Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I said, you guys don't ask me, all right, what I think about all of these social
mm-hmm.
policy and health care and other
yeah.
issues, and I won't tell you. All right,
mm-hmm.
I got a responsibility in capital markets. I'm going to do capital markets. But the thing that's really fascinating was they would always ask me about these other social policy issues,
mm-hmm.
and I would always tell them why I thought they were out to lunch.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but I didn't leak to the press. All right, you know, we had a very professional relationship along those lines. And they discovered that from their view, they had an economically rational, authentic Democrat, right, working in the White House.
So were they mostly, so you said that, that one of the big things, you were working on saving loans and takeovers primarily?
Yeah, those were the main capital
okay.
markets issues at the time. There were many other issues, but all of them were an order of magnitude less important.
Were you studying the effects of regulation on these issues or just looking at them more broadly?
Well, it was a broader look
okay.
from the Council of Economic Advisors.
Uh-huh.
We would look at the effects of regulation, but
mm-hmm.
you would also have to think about what should the administration's strategy be.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work with Congress? What kind of legislation do you wind up pushing? How do you respond to the emerging issues in each one of these different areas?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get all of the different branches of the executive branch working together.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You've got to get the Commerce Department on board. You've got to get Treasury on board, primarily Treasury. You know, you develop the political skills
mm-hmm.
of taking a group of people within an organization, a large organization, having 20 different opinions and saying, guys, we've got to come up with a consensus view that we can all sign on. And, you know, one of my jobs was saying, okay, we're going to develop a consensus, and if there was somebody that wasn't on board, you either had to persuade them or have somebody go tell them,
mm-hmm.
all right, get on board.
Sure. Can you tell me about studying takeovers? Because that seems like it would be particularly contentious.
Yeah, it was very contentious. And one of the reasons why it was contentious was it highlighted a split within the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And let's oversimplify. Let's say that there's a market-oriented wing of the Republican Party and a corporatist wing of the Republican Party. the market-oriented wing would say, hey, let takeovers happen, all right, because if you structure them properly, they can be very efficient means to redeploy capital, to discipline management, to rationally give voice to shareholders. But then there's the corporatist wing of the Republican Party, which says, hey, wait a minute, we're the CEOs. These takeovers threaten our ability to run the companies the way we want to, all right? And we're the ones that set corporate policy, and we're major supporters, so we are actually opposed to takeover activity. So, and you had an equivalent split in the Democratic Party as well, because there, you know, you had large groups who said, gee, we like takeovers. Why? Because they can actually be threatening to management. And then you had groups that say, we hate takeovers. Why? Because after a takeover, people tend to get laid off. So the takeover battles really there's a certain sense in which they were simultaneously profoundly political, but political along dimensions that didn't give rise to clear Democrat-Republican lineups. So, you know, the challenge that I had was, look, there's a particular point of view. You know, mine was clearly on the markets-oriented point of view. You got to have efficient capital allocation. And that's the view that we got the Reagan administration to back up and support over a lot of opposition from within the Republican Party. You know, so here I was, a, you know, fresh-faced, ridiculously young, bearded Democrat trying to persuade all of these Republicans, hey, guys, this is the way you got to go. And they're looking at me and they're going, you know, who are you, all right, to move us in this direction? But we got it done. We got it done.
How did you make your, how did you make the case? Did you, through studies or?
No, I relied primarily on my remarkable good looks. No, actually, it was a purely logical process. Okay. And there was a tremendous amount of opposition, but you know, I thought the economic data were very clear. You know, by the same token, you couldn't let the process run amok in an extremely unregulated manner, for a wide variety of reasons, including the fact that the political process wouldn't support it. So you had to come up with a rational, measured approach that would allow markets to evolve in a way that the political process would support.
Okay. Now, it's about this time that you move over to the SEC. How did... Can you tell me about that process?
Sure. You know, what can I say? I was the luckiest bastard you'll ever meet. By statute, the SEC can't have more than three members of the same political party as the president. So they had their Republican nominee, Ed Fleischman, and there was a Democratic opening, and they had to look around, and they said, well, where in the world are we going to find a Democrat that the Reagan White House could support for a chair on the SEC? And they looked around, and they said, well, you know that crazy bearded guy over at the Council of Economic Advisors? He's a Democrat. We all know that. He really is authentically a Democrat. I mean, you know, and all of this other stuff that we feel strongly about, he thinks we're nuts. But on everything related to the SEC, he's the guy that has helped pull our policy together. He's the one that's, you know, helped us herd the cats. And we don't have to tell him how to think like a free market-oriented regulator. That's what he thinks. That's what he does. So it's really only because there was, only because the statute places a limit, which is based on party affiliation, only because I was in the White House and, what can I say, in a certain sense, ironically, hadn't compromised my principles. Had I said, well, okay, let me become a Republican so that I could advance in this environment, I never would have made it to the SEC. It was only because I was a Democrat, wasn't going to compromise on that, and again, was entirely authentic in terms of my view about markets and how they operate and regulation, that I wound up, again, just being very lucky, the right person at the right time, because you don't get on the SEC when you're 33 years old, which was, you know, my age at that time, without special circumstances.
Had you dealt with the SEC at all while you were at the CEA?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, it dealt with them very, very rarely, okay. You know, and it really only was, you know, at the staff level.
Okay.
You know, and entirely informational. We were very careful not to do anything that could be perceived as the executive branch attempting to influence anything that an independent agency was doing. So all the connections that I recall, number one, there were very few. Mm-hmm. And number two, they were all informational.
Okay.
The kind of stuff where today you would go to the internet and you would get the documents and you would say, well, all right, clarify the sequence. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the internet then, so I'd have to call somebody up and I'd say, well, could you go through your files and find X, Y, and Z and send over a copy?
Right.
And they were all public, you know, documents, that kind of thing.
So you didn't say, look at what the Tender Offer Advisory Committee was recommending, or study that, or provide recommendations.
Oh no, we wouldn't. We would no. They had their own committee, and that was, you know, and that was it. We would follow it, you know. But you know, they had their committee, and God bless them.
Okay. So you are an economist coming to the SEC. Can you tell me a little bit about the state of economics?
I'm an economist and a lawyer.
Right. That's
coming
true.
To the SEC.
That's true.
All right, and I have background in both, and you know, there was a debate at the time that I got on board, all right, and there was a view about, you know, many people, you know, I'll be candid, you know, that I wasn't qualified, all right, to be a commissioner, that other people certainly knew more about the securities laws than I at the time, and I'll be the first person to say, yes, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. All right. At 33, I was not the most experienced securities lawyer, and you know, but on the other hand, I was an economist, and I was a relatively newly trained economist, and understood things like how futures markets operated, how derivatives markets operated, understood what computerized trading meant for the markets. You know, and you look at computerized trading today, and you compare it with what was happening then, it's night and day. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big deal back then was index arbitrage. Mm-hmm. All right, you know, how is it that you take price signals from the Chicago markets and actually trade equities so that you're able to make an almost guaranteed profit? Well, you know, it was really quaint. You know, people would have, you know, these old IBM computers, and they would be running this code, and it was very primitive compared to what people are doing now. But there were very few people at the SEC then who understood this stuff. And you know, it took a while to demonstrate to people that kind of understanding, that being an economist and a lawyer, you know, combined in one person, really was a value add to the process.
Because economic analysis in and of itself was a relatively new idea at the SEC.
Well, yeah, economic analysis at the time was a relatively new idea, and not only was it a new idea, it was a new idea that wasn't really embraced by the organization. Let me tell you a story about how I got into trouble very early on. I gave a quote that wound up in Fortune magazine, and they featured it one issue as the, like, you know, quote of the month, and some people had asked me, you know, what was it that I had learned from my early service at the SEC that surprised me, and I said, well, you know, it's interesting, you know, there may be 10 people in the whole building who have a real deep understanding of how markets actually work in the world today, and that's a little bit like saying that the Food and Drug Administration only has, you know, 10 doctors or 10 chemists or 10 biologists, because everybody else is a lawyer, all right? And they're great lawyers, but they don't have a deep understanding of how the markets actually work. Boy, did I get in trouble. Boy, oh boy, did I get in trouble with the staff, all right? They let me know almost immediately that they did not appreciate, all right, my characterization of the staff skills, all right, along those lines. And you know, number one, they let me know that they knew everything that they needed to know about the operation of the markets. And in all candor, I bit my tongue, all right, because I sort of said, well, this is a part of the problem, all right, at the building, all right, that you actually think that what you know is everything that you need to know. It's not. There's much more that we need to know. There's much more we need to do. And that's a certain sense of hubris. I think the agency has evolved from that. I think it's much better today, all right, than it was then. But I think we still have a ways to go, right? And the you know the other thing, I quickly learned that if you were going to be a commissioner, you couldn't perpetually be at war with the staff. You have to pick your battles, and the staff's view is commissioners come and go. We're here forever, all right? You know, they knew that I wasn't going to be there 20 years. You know, they knew that 4 or 5 years I'm going to be gone. So, you know, the staff can develop a strategy that says, okay, we have to follow, you know, a containment and management approach with regard to any commissioner or even any chairman, because at some point they're gone. We're career. We're here for the next 20 years. They're not. So I learned a good bit about commissioner-staff dynamics, and I learned to pick my fights. And I learned, you know, strategies that could actually work and strategies that would just antagonize people and would fail.
What were the sorts of things that you thought needed to be, that they could improve?
Well, you know, without getting into specifics, and one reason I'm not going to get into specifics is like 30 years ago.
Sure.
I don't remember that many of them anymore. Just the general view that incorporating market thinking about how actual markets work, really would be essential to the success of the agency's enterprise. And the way the agency worked then, and I fear it continues to work this way, and I hope it's changing, is that the staff and the commissioners would develop a policy view. And that policy view could be rooted in a variety of things. It could be, you know, rooted in a political perspective. It could be rooted in a, you know, ideology. It could be rooted in a particular legal view about how a statute should or shouldn't be interpreted. But it would rarely be rooted in terms of an economic analysis of, well, okay, what's the efficient result?
Right.
What interpretation of this rule, what application of this rule leads to the best market performance? The economic analysis was then always tacked on at the end. You would say, well, all right, this is what we want to do, and now let's have the economists write up why this is the smart thing. It would be relatively rare. It would happen. But it would be relatively rare that you would bring in the economic thinking right at the beginning and say, let's approach this problem like an economist and then make the rules fit the economic analysis. Okay. And there are many reasons for that. In particular, there were very few people in the building that had the skill set to do that. Most of the people in the building at the time were terrific securities lawyers, and based their reasoning on a skill set that was very different from the traditional skill set that a economist would bring to the table if they looked at it differently. You know, and you know, one of my colleagues, Charles Cox, was a pure economist, and you know, Charles would tend to look at issues that way, as would I, and you know, he and I would often have conversations where we'd share our frustrations, kind of going like, you know, this is backwards. And it was backwards in many situations. You know, and if you want to fast forward, you know, clearly the D.C. Circuit's decision in Business Roundtable is extraordinarily controversial. And, you know, many people will try to persuade you that the decision was wrongly decided and what have you. Let's put that debate aside for the moment. You got to that decision, I think, because the D.C. Circuit looked at the rule, looked at the support for the rule, and said that the agency really paid no attention to the underlying logic of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
That the agency had reached a political conclusion, and they then were trying to pound a square peg into a round hole by suggesting that the data supported their conclusion. All right. Now, I would have written the D.C. Circuit's decision quite differently,
mm-hmm.
but I would have come to the same conclusion. So, you know, I don't want to stand up and say that I would agree with you know, every point made in mm-hmm. the Business Roundtable decision.
Right.
But I would agree with the conclusion that, you know, that rule was not based on an economically rational approach to the problem.
Do you think that there are different views of what the SEC's role is in terms of investor protection versus market efficiency?
Well, of course they're different.
And that causes that?
Yeah, well, of course they're different views. But you know, what's interesting is if you look at it again, as an economist without an axe to grind,
mm-hmm.
Investor protection and market efficiency are really two ways of saying the same thing.
Okay.
How do you run a market most efficiently? How do you run a market in a way where buyers get what they're bargaining for at the lowest possible price,
mm-hmm.
sellers get what they're bargaining for at the highest possible price, and you minimize the amount of friction in the process? You minimize also the cost of complying with the regulations, because complying with these regulations is not free.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it's investors who wind up paying for the compliance. So mm-hmm. you have to think about that too. And you know, part of the problem, you know, really is reflected in the way you ask the question, because that's how some people think mm-hmm. about it. It's the battle between, you know, investor protection and market efficiency. No, it's not. It's the same problem, all right, just looking at two different variables in the equation.
Mm-hmm. So you dealt with a number of different topics in your time at the commission. There were a lot of things kind of coming to a head at that point. Some of the ones, there's a number that I'm interested in, but you continue to deal with the idea with the issue of tender offers and takeovers mm-hmm. at the commission. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yeah, it was one of the hot issues of the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, how do you set up the takeover rules? All right, you know, where do you set the different thresholds? Where do you set the different guidelines? What kind of disclosure are you going to require? You know, should the SEC be involved, you know, in terms of, you know, Delaware's litigation mm-hmm. on poison pills and the like? I mean, these issues, you know, came up everywhere. What do you say to Congress when Congress is thinking of amending the Williams Act and the like? And the resolution of these questions, especially when they get to the level of Congress, is essentially political. You know, what I tried to do was develop a economically principled approach, right? And say, look, here's my position, and here are the economic and public policy reasons why this probably leads to the most efficient result for everyone,
mm-hmm.
and why it's good for investor protection. All right, it's good for the macro economy. It minimizes the cost of compliance with regulation. Regulation, you know, would seem to generate benefits higher than the cost, and I would immediately recognize I'm going to have to compromise. There's no way that you're going to be able to get everything.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try to figure out the best set of compromises. What'll I give up? That's the political process. Nobody ever gets everything they want, not even the president. So why would the most junior member of the SEC ever think that he's going to get everything he wants?
Can you give me an example of that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, let me give you an example of a situation that came up. There was the Delaware courts were then trying to figure out how to handle poison pills,
mm-hmm.
and we had the question as to whether we should write a brief, mm-hmm. you know, supporting or, you know, rejecting poison pills. And it's my recollection that we wrote a brief arguing against poison pills.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Again, you're asking me to go back more than 30 years, and, you know, if it turns out that's wrong, and I've, you know, I'm practicing revisionist history now, let's correct the record. But, you know, my recollection is we filed a brief, and the Delaware courts disagreed with us,
mm-hmm.
We sort of sat back, we looked at it, and we said, well, let's monitor what's going on here,
mm-hmm.
all right, you know, and instead of saying, gee, we need immediately to respond, at least, you know, because at the time I viewed this as inconsistent with a, you know, more free market approach
mm-hmm.
to take over activity. I said, well, all right, let's not do anything rash, all right? Let's not do something from a regulatory perspective at the SEC. Let's not try to get any legislation, you know, federal legislation in this area through Congress. There were
mm-hmm.
people that wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, all right, let's run the experiment, all right? Just because we disagree and just because we would do things differently, this isn't a situation where we should be so cocksure that we're right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what happens, and if things wind up going off the rails, there are a lot of things we can then do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what happens. So you know, the world didn't come to an end, all right? You know, people learned how to evolve. You could have the view today that the world would be better off if there were no poison pills.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like we're dead because there are poison pills. So you know, I think that's an interesting example,
mm-hmm.
you know, responsive to your question.
Mm-hmm. One of the, that sort of gets into the issue of the rights of shareholders versus the prerogatives of management.
Sure.
One of the things that I remember seeing is that you at different points, you or early on argued that shareholders should be allowed to opt out of certain corporate regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me some of what led you to argue that? And
well, sure. I mean, it, you know, a basic premise of corporate law in many ways is that the statute is a form contract,
mm-hmm.
and then you could opt into and opt out of different provisions in the statute, and provided people are appropriately informed, that kind of customization should lead to socially optimal results.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, in many ways, a relatively non-controversial proposition, unless people are going to wind up agreeing to terms with which you disagree, all right? Which then, or if you think the process by which people reach these decisions is inherently inefficient, mm-hmm. ill-informed, and unable to reach the social optimum, and you know better what the social optimum is than this imperfect process. I mean, you know, one of the problems that I see in government regulation across the board is that regulators tend to look at the markets and they tend to say, well, you know, the markets, they make mistakes all the time. You know, and I go, well, yes, of course they do. Look at all the decisions they have to make. They can't all be right,
mm-hmm.
all right? Impossible. And in fact, it's entirely conceivable that all of them are wrong,
mm-hmm.
all right?
Right.
But that's not the question. The question is, can you as a regulator, or at the time, can we as regulators in Washington, on average and over time, do better,
mm-hmm.
all right, than the markets? Because we as regulators, we're very, very human. We're susceptible to a whole different set of influences, you know, some of which are perfectly fine, others of which you don't want to talk about in public,
mm-hmm.
all right? And we make mistakes, too. So in the real world, the question is, which set of mistakes you want to live with,
mm-hmm.
all right? You want to live with the imperfections that the market generates, or you want to live with the imperfections that the regulators generate? And part of the art, I think, of being a really good regulator is to have humility,
mm-hmm.
and to say, you know, I could be wrong about this, and if I'm going to try to push the market to a result different from the one that the market would generate on its own, I have to have some confidence
mm-hmm.
that I'm solving a market failure, I'm contributing to the process in a way that, on average and over time, you don't have to get it right every time. You can't get it right every time. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the decisions as a group, we wind up in a better place.
It's sort of the democracy is the worst form of government except for all the rest.
Absolutely.
Same idea.
Yeah, and to me, a large part of the frustration is, you know, the number of people who go running around saying, the market's got this wrong, the market's got that wrong, therefore we need to regulate, to which I go, whoa. Do you really think I'm that stupid? I mean, because you know that the regulators are going to get it wrong, too.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, you know, the real frustration is, obviously, if you're in the regulation business and the government's in the regulation business,
mm-hmm.
telling half the story is a very, very effective thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right? We must act. Why? Because the market got this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I get it. Let's agree the market got it wrong. Now, explain to me why you think consistently you're going to get it right. Now,
mm-hmm.
there are situations where the government's got a great story to tell. All right, and where regulators have a great story to tell, and where you need government regulation, you must have government regulation. You wouldn't want to live in a world without it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there are other situations where maybe the envelope is pressed a little too far.
So the sort of the converse of that is shareholder determination on things like takeover defenses and exclusionary tender offers. Did you hold the same view with regards to those that shareholders should opt in?
My view basically was strongly in the area of self-determination.
Okay.
All right? That to the extent you could get government out of the business of telling corporations how to run themselves,
mm-hmm.
that would be a good idea. The challenge, of course, was different people have different views about how corporations should run themselves. You have the battle between management and shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent does a corporate action require approval of management, and to what extent can shareholders act on their own initiative?
Mm-hmm.
Very complex issue, and there's a range of opinion about it in academia and also among practitioners and in the corporate governance world. You've got the, you know, extreme shareholder determinists, you know, people like, you know, Professor Bebchuk at Harvard, and then you've got the extreme corporatists, you know, people like Marty Lipton, and, you know, I consider both of them perfectly good friends.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the two of them will never agree.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm between the two of them. All right, there's some situations where you want to let the shareholders decide the matter. There are other situations where, you know, you look at it as a question of representative democracy. You know, the problem with letting shareholders decide everything, it becomes a little bit like the initiative process we have here in California,
mm-hmm.
which is crazy-making in many situations. There's a reason why representative democracy tends to work well.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many situations in which the corporate governance process is best understood as representative democracy. And with all of its flaws and with all of its foibles, can often be better than direct democracy. And you know, but that's a contestable proposition. And I appreciate that.
So one of the issues that sort of gets into that the commission dealt with while you were there is the one share, one vote rule.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just curious to get your perspective on that.
Sure. Can we take a short break?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. So one share, one vote, you know, very interesting. I think my views at the time were very strongly fashioned by many other aspects of the policy debate as it was evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm going back more than 30 years,
right.
And the record will speak for itself. My present muddled recollection is that I was concerned that the trajectory was moving too far towards the management side of the spectrum, and that these corporate voting structures other than one share, one vote would be potentially damaging to mm-hmm. the operation of a market process,
sure.
that it tilted the scale too far towards management. And that view was fashioned by the fact that you had the emergence of poison pills,
mm-hmm.
you had other factors that caused me at the time to believe that it was moving too much in the management corporatist direction.
Okay.
Now, looking back in hindsight, I say, gee, you know, maybe I was wrong. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are situations where if shareholders, you know, buy into the concept, you know, early on, you know, mm-hmm. appropriately, and they understand what it is they're getting into, that having multiple classes of shares is an economically efficient result.
Mm-hmm.
You know, big debate here in Silicon Valley, you know, as we're talking, you know, now, there are a bunch of companies that have gone public with, you know, dual class share structures,
mm-hmm.
you know, where, you know, at Google, the founders have their Class B shares, and there was just a settlement the other day about the issuance of non-voting Class C shares, so you're going to have the founders' shares with 10 votes each, you have the publicly traded A shares with one vote,
mm-hmm.
and you're now going to have C shares, right, which will have no votes.
Mm-hmm.
At Facebook, the founder has his shares, all right, and clearly has voting control of the company that way. At Zynga, where the company is not doing well, the founder has control. So in many of these situations, what you're telling the stockholders is not only are you buying stock in the company, you're betting on this particular management team running the company.
Mm-hmm.
And if they screw up, your ability to discipline them is going to be very limited. Now, you have to ask whether you want into that kind of a mm-hmm. structure. At a time, there was a time when I would have made that difficult to do. My views on that have evolved,
mm-hmm.
and I see a place in a robust market for having companies that have those structures. And again, we're going to learn when are the circumstances where they make sense, when are the circumstances where they don't make sense,
mm-hmm.
and there'll be situations where they don't make sense and they will unravel of their own weight. That's my prediction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the other things that is happening at this time in governance is that the activist institutional investors are becoming much more of a factor. Can you tell me what your perspective was on that from the SEC?
Yeah, my perspective was that shareholders have always had more power than they understood, and they weren't intelligently using the power that they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that observation led me to write one of my you know, early law review articles when I went into academia, you know, called Just Vote No,
mm-hmm.
where the premise was really very simple, and that is, you know, sure, directors... Sure, shareholders can't nominate their own directors, and you have 9 slots on a board, and the board nominates itself.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that shareholders are powerless. You have the ability to withhold authority, all right, to vote for a director, and by withholding authority, you in effect embarrass the directors.
Mm-hmm.
And semiotics can be very, very powerful. The symbolism of a director, you know, not getting a majority vote for their re-election is something that directors will care about.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that form of soft power that, you know, I think it was 1990 that I wrote about,
mm-hmm.
or 91, that shareholders are not using effectively, and you don't need to write any rules, you don't need to write... It's a little bit like, you know, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. You've always had the ruby slippers, all right? You just need to, you know, click your heels, uh-huh. and you can wind up back in Kansas. And, you know, at the time I was writing, shareholders, you have much more power than you realize. Use it intelligently. And what's intriguing is it took the idea, you know, about 20 years to gain traction. So now... Everybody says we're going to run a Just Vote No campaign. Mm-hmm. All right, you know, we don't like compensation at this company, so we're going to vote against these directors. You know, or look at JP Morgan. All right, we're going to vote against the directors on the risk committee, and they're leaving. All right, and that's without the shareholders having the formal authority to fire the directors.
Mm-hmm.
My point was, you don't need that formal authority. You need to wield the soft authority that you have and that mm-hmm. you've had for decades more intelligently and effectively. So you know, there's a sense in which, you know, I look at much of what's happening in the corporate governance area mm-hmm. now and shareholder activism, you know, and especially around the ideas of these Just Vote No campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's what I've been saying for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a very imperfect process. I mean, you know, in my own personal view, there's some situations where shareholders are acting quite stupidly,
mm-hmm.
all right, and criticizing the wrong companies for the wrong reasons. And there are other situations where I think they've got it spot on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the fact that this is an imperfect process that makes mistakes doesn't mean that it isn't the best available process.
Why do you think the idea took so long to catch on?
Because it came from an academic. No, I'm kidding. The short answer is I don't know.
Okay.
I actually think this was a tremendously missed opportunity that took them, you know, decades. This is an area where I just look at the institutional investors and I say, guys, you know, I gave speeches, I told you how to mm-hmm. do it, and it took you 20 years to make it effective. I don't know why. To me, it seemed like low-hanging fruit.
You think they're too focused on the hard power issues, like not the ability to nominate directors and things like that?
Or I think that's a piece of it.
Okay.
I think that they say, you know, we need to have the ability to change directors. We mm-hmm. need to have X, Y, and Z. To which my response is, you know something? You can do so much with the power you already have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure many of them felt like, you know, we don't want to do it because then we don't have an argument to try to get even more power.
Hmm.
All right? If we can actually use the power that we have effectively, then people can argue we don't need any more power than that. To which my response is, exactly. And their response is, but we want more power. And I kind of go, well, wait a minute. Well, why don't you use what you already... I mean, if you can solve the problem with this hammer,
uh-huh.
all right... And you don't need a screwdriver. Why do you say, give me a screwdriver, give me a screwdriver? Hey, but that's, they want a screwdriver.
Right.
All right. Cool.
So there, some of the other things that were happening in your time, to go back to your time at the SEC, there's a lot, you had things like the insider trading scandals.
Oh, yeah.
Ivan
Boesky, Michael Milken, that other good stuff.
And then the options listing, safe harbor rules. Were there things that stood out to you as the most significant?
Well, you know, let's do the insider trading.
Sure.
Because that's an issue that's still with us.
Yes.
You know, I remember, you know, the Ivan Boesky, you know, situation, which was, you know, dealt with as a very serious situation within the agency, and everybody was gobsmacked. About the amount of trading mm-hmm. and the extent to which, you know, people were violating confidences and what have you. And, you know, one of the things that you immediately understood was that the existence of this kind of insider trading was corrosive in terms of confidence that people would have in the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, look, you also had economists then who were arguing that insider trading shouldn't be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that's one of the dumbest economic arguments I've ever heard in my entire life. Because if you think about material non-public information as being trade secret information, proprietary information,
mm-hmm.
all right, which it is, and if you're liable for insider trading only if you misappropriate that information,
mm-hmm.
then if you believe there shouldn't be insider trading laws, then, well, let's get rid of intellectual property laws. But you can never sue anybody else for disclosing a secret. You can never keep a secret.
Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly, economists would say that's wrong. All right? Well, same thing here. The fundamental intellectual mistake
mm-hmm.
that the finance economists made when they were arguing against regulation of insider trading was they didn't understand that this was an intellectual property issue,
mm-hmm.
not a pure finance issue.
Sure.
And, you know, it's also a compensation issue, because if you have people in a company and they know what your earnings release is going to be, well, then whoever has enough money to buy the largest position is the one who's going to make the most money from it, not necessarily the employee who contributed the most to it. And at that point, management loses ability to set compensation in any rational way. The board of directors loses ability to say, I want to reward this person, not the other person, because it's, you know, whoever can capitalize and steal the corporation's information most effectively winds up getting the biggest gain. Well, that's no way to run an efficient compensation mechanism. That's no way effectively to capitalize on the corporation's intellectual property. It's a prescription for chaos and disaster. You know, so I, as an economist, I never had a second's hesitation enforcing anti-insider trading regimes, especially built on a misappropriation theory. And I understand why many, many, you know, lawyers were concerned about the misappropriation theory. No, it's not an issue. It's great. Let's go for it.
Which, but it was tough to, I mean, there was a while where it was kind of touch and go as to whether it would be allowed under the, by the courts.
Under misappropriation. Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I always thought the misappropriation theory made a lot of sense. And there was a big issue around that. And, you know, I know people were concerned. Gee, is the economist going to, you know, support insider trading regulation? The answer is, this economist is ready to lead the charge for it on purely economic grounds. You know, put aside the fact that it's politically popular. All right, that's a nice bonus under those circumstances, but that wasn't the reason why I was opposed to insider trading. Right, it's not that, that was not the dominant reason why I was opposed to it.
There's a number of other areas where there's sort of that issues of trying to make the markets more efficient. I think of things like options lists, like multiple listing of options, and like I said, the safe harbor rules. Can you talk about like the other market efficiency issues that, that you dealt with?
Well, look, you know, at the end of the day, the short answer is competition tends to be good. So allow multiple listings. Okay, you know, have different marketplaces, you know, compete. Who can do the best job? All right. Well, there you go. That's the market that, that should prevail in that environment. You know, unless there's an argument that says by fragmenting the markets, you actually wind up hurting, all right, too many people. And that is a perfectly credible argument. And there you have it. I mean, and there are other situations where you want to say, look, we don't really know. Let's run an experiment. Let's see what happens.
One of the, I think, the market break kind of flies in the face of that, or people, not flies in the face, but sort of brought the desire for regulation to the fore again. Can you talk a little about the market break?
Oh, sure. The market break, I thought, 1987 market break, to me was fascinating for a wide variety of reasons. Where to start? One was to recognize there's a certain sense in which we were lucky in terms of how we got out of the problem. There were many mistakes that we came close to making that we didn't make. One of the biggest ones would have been, I think, to shut the markets down. There were many people in the building who wanted to do that. I was strongly opposed to doing that. There were also problems, I think, in the building that arose because, again, I'll go back to an earlier point that I made, many people did not understand how markets worked. They didn't understand that you had futures markets and that price discovery was occurring in the futures markets. They didn't understand mechanisms of transmission, and they had no idea about portfolio insurance. They had no idea of you know, all of a sudden liquidity can be extraordinarily expensive. They didn't understand how clearing corporations worked, and that if you had questions about the solvency of clearing corporations, that could send shivers throughout the entire, you know, marketplace. And you had some people say, well, who cares about the clearing corporations? It has nothing to do with the stock market. That's the Chicago mm-hmm. futures market. You know, why are we worried about that? Right. I'm kind of going, are you out of your mind? I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, gee, you know, you want to cut off my left leg, that's okay. I've got a right leg. Okay, they're connected. All right? You need to run a race. You're not going to be able to hop along. Uh-huh. Okay? You know, you lose a leg, you go down. Mm-hmm. All right? And, you know, it was, in a certain sense, very frustrating to me to be in the middle of right. this kind of crisis and to hear lots of views where, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm kind of going, this is a problem. These people are not fully informed, and you don't really have time to educate people mm-hmm. in the middle of a plane crash. Mm-hmm. All right, that's right. not all right. So that was an issue that I perceived, sure. you know, at the time. You know, and again, there were a small number of people who got it, and fortunately, the ball was passed to the small number of people who got it, and. I think we made the right decisions mm-hmm. and we got lucky.
Sure. Okay.
And anybody who tells you it was just because of the right decisions we knew what we were doing, they're either lying to you or they didn't understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. All right. It was we did make the right decisions and we got really lucky.
Okay. Are there any other things from your time at the SEC that you feel like we should cover?
I'm gonna leave that totally up to you. I feel talked out okay. on that point.
I think we've hit the big ones.
Sure.
You left the SEC in 1990. Did you?
Correct.
And so, what brought you to Stanford?
Have you seen the weather? I mean, yeah. Why would you not? I mean, no. Actually, my wife's family was here in Palo Alto. Her father is a faculty member.
Okay.
Taught fluid mechanics. And, you know, I sort of looked around and I said, you know, I've got three things I could do with my life at this point. I could go back and practice law. I could go to Wall Street and try to become a master of the universe. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's very interested in computerized trading and, you know, could do hedge fund stuff.
Sure.
Or I could try my hand at being a professor. And, I was always interested in academia and teaching, mm-hmm. and I said, you know, if I don't try this professor thing now, I'll never do it. Mm-hmm. I can try this professor thing, and if I don't like it, or if I fail at it, I can go to Wall Street, mm-hmm. or I can do a law firm. All right, so of the three big alternatives I saw, only one was now or never.
Okay.
All right, and that was academia. And I was always interested in it, and I said, let's try it. And, you know, there were a bunch of schools where, you know, I could have gone and gotten tenure immediately. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'd rather do Stanford. And I came here, you know, no tenure. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to earn my tenure the same way everybody else does. I'm going to earn my stripes. I'm going to do the writing. I'm going to do the research. And there you go. Mm-hmm. And now they can't get rid of me.
Were there particularly topics that you came in wanting to study?
Well, sure. I mean, we already talked about corporate governance. Mm-hmm. All right. You know, that was definitely a topic that I wanted to study.
Okay.
So the three. I mean, I wrote three articles. You know, relatively quickly, got tenure. You know, mm-hmm. very very quickly. You know, one of them was Just Vote No. Mm-hmm. It was about corporate governance.
Right.
And again, the idea being shareholders, you know, have more voice. All right. Then there was another piece which was purely legal. Disimplying private rights of action,
okay.
that the Supreme Court implied a private right of action mm-hmm. under 10b. Well, if you can imply a private right of action, then there are things that the SEC can do, if it wanted to, mm-hmm. under 10b, to disimply the right.
Okay.
Because if you look at the statute is merely a delegation of authority to the SEC. It's... Mm. 10b says it shall be, you know, unlawful to violate regulations adopted by the SEC.
Okay.
All right. Well, if the SEC adopts a different set of regulations, then that which is illegal in violation of 10b-5 is different. Mm-hmm. And the SEC, if it wanted to, could say, look, private rights of action, you know, have to meet a higher standard. Mm-hmm. All right, they can't lower the standard under what the statute requires, but the SEC, if it wanted to, could rate. I mean, there's no legal requirement that the SEC support an implication of the private rights to the fullest extent permissible by the statute.
Mm-hmm.
The SEC, if it wanted to, could always carve back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a piece of pure legal analysis, all right, establishing a point that hadn't been in the literature to then, and that the SEC has proceeded to ignore. All right, very pervasively and successfully. And, well, yes, as a matter, but politically, the agency is not about to say we're not going to prohibit fraud to the fullest extent of the law. Okay,
right.
So that's where that is. And the third piece that I did was some professors at Harvard and Yale had written a piece on limited liability. And arguing that you could get rid of corporate limited liability,
okay. And
you could have unlimited liability for shareholders. And I sort of looked at that and I said, well, that's just wrong, because once you understand how derivative contracts work, all right, you can, in effect, synthesize limited liability, and these ideas about unlimited liability will generate stock holdings in certain patterns where it's all going to be held by, you know, bankruptcy-proof entities that aren't going to have any assets that you can attach. I mean, you know, I looked at the idea and I said, it would take me 3 seconds to engineer around this. So I wrote a piece called The Limited Future of Unlimited Liability, all right, which was, you know, I think a very nice application of derivatives and structuring to say, look, I understand what this Harvard and Yale professor, I understand what they're trying to do. Right, and you know, their heart's in the right place. I got it. But, you know, this is never going to fly. Let me tell you why this has to fail. And then I, for a tenure piece, that's perfect.
Yeah.
All right, you have two giants in the field. They write and say, you know, this is going to be a great idea. And I write, and they go, you know, not so much. Okay? and the not so much side of the argument has prevailed. So you know, that was the immediate research agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, your second piece on private rights of action, did that was that the PSLRA passes in 95? Are we talking about the same sorts of private litigation, securities litigation?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. And then you know, I did a lot of work around the PSLRA. Uh-huh. I was involved in the debates, you know, having to do with the adoption of the PSLRA. Done a lot of research, right, around the PSL. You know, we run this securities clearinghouse,
right.
Which, you know, when we launched it in 1995, 1996, was pathbreaking because nobody was doing anything in the legal space on the internet, and it was an entirely new way of data collection and of doing open research on the internet.
Sure.
You know, now here at Stanford, we've got a variety of databases that are doing the same sorts of things. We have intellectual property database. We're thinking about, you know, building and launching additional ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole area of legal research is being revolutionized, and I think, you know, much to the benefit of the scholarly process. You know, the PSLRA was perfect from that perspective because all of the litigation is public, all right, and you had to file a notice every time you file a complaint. So we just set up a set of screens, again, in the early days of the internet. This was hot stuff. And we could just track every company that was being sued, and you'd never had another area of law where you could go to a computer and... LexisNexis was tracking the decisions. Well, it's too late by the time a decision comes down, all right? That's like saying, here's the death certificate, all right? What you want to know is the birth certificate. All right, which are the new lawsuits and what are the complaints being filed?
Right,
and that was the novelty. We started tracking the full life cycle of litigation. Complaints filed. We've got a copy of the complaint. Here are the motions. You can see everything. Now today we have PACER. All right, but this basically was PACER before there was PACER.
Right.
All right, and you know, it was ahead of its time. And that's the perfect thing to do in Silicon Valley. That's one of the great things about being here and, you know, soaking up a little bit of the atmosphere of innovation and interest in computers.
Okay. One of the things that I see you focused on is working with directors and yeah. looking at the role of directors on a board.
Sure.
Can you tell me about some of your work with directors?
Yeah, we run a directors college here uh-huh. at Stanford. Next year is going to be our 20th anniversary,
mm-hmm.
And we run the program in a very practical manner.
Mm-hmm.
We always ask ourselves, if you're serving on the board of a publicly traded company, what are your high-profile problem issues,
okay.
and what are some really good practical solutions? So examples for this year. Our opening plenary session is on cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a real problem, and it's a problem on many different levels, including the fact that the vast majority of directors of publicly traded corporations have no frigging idea about cybersecurity problems or cybersecurity solutions. So how do you deal with a situation where boards simply don't know what they don't know?
Uh-huh.
So we've got a panel with, you know, one of the leading cybersecurity people from the FBI, you know, Mary Gallagher. She's going to start, and mm-hmm. she's going to scare the bejesus out of the audience. She's going to give them real stories about real hacks and, you know, who's lost information and uh-huh. that stuff. Louis Free is on the panel. He's going to say, you know, I used to run the FBI and the whole bit, and what Mary's saying is exactly right. And, you know, he's now working with the private sector. You know, here's mm-hmm. what we're doing. We've got Gordy Davidson, all right, you know, who's one of the local lawyers mm-hmm. who represents a lot of the cybersecurity companies. And he'll talk about what he sees in the boardroom and the like. And then we've got, you know, this guy, George Schultz, not the other George Schultz, who's going to talk about a variety of different strategies that mm-hmm. are very new and out of the box in terms right. of what corporations can do. You know, and the pitch that I'm going to make is, look, there are many issues about which boards of directors themselves are not fully qualified.
Uh-huh.
All right? And there are many things you can do. You can try to train some directors so that they have more knowledge. That's possible. Many directors aren't going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You could try to put on your board a director who has cybersecurity expertise. Most boards are not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could do what most corporations do in situations where you need more expertise. You hire an expert.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And boards, you know, do that all the time. You hire investment bankers.
Mm-hmm.
You hire a lawyer. You hire special counsel to do internal investigations. You hire auditors to double-check books. Why not hire, you know, what I call cyber counsel? Doesn't have to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Hire an expert on cybersecurity. Have that person report to the board, all right, and have that person also responsible for testing the performance of the corporation mm-hmm. itself on cybersecurity.
Okay.
Because one of the problems that we run into is many boards look to the IT department to brief the board on cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the IT department is in charge of making sure that you don't have any hacks.
Mm-hmm.
And putting them in charge of telling you how well they're doing is a little bit like having the CFO do his own audit.
Right.
So it's not the best division of responsibility. And that's the reason why I'm pushing towards the idea of cyber counsel, okay. or cyber expert, you know, uh-huh. you know, advisor, cyber advisor, all right, to the board. And we'll see what happens. I mean, that's the kind of conversation sure. that we tend to have at Directors College.
You said you started it 20 years ago. Was
yeah.
there something that was going on there
yeah.
that
was screening that independent directors of publicly traded corporations needed more information and shared knowledge
okay.
about how to be a good director.
Uh-huh.
That there were some directors were absolutely terrific, other directors were clueless.
Mm-hmm.
But that there would be great opportunity for shared knowledge. And at the time, there was very little director education. And now, you know, every audit firm has, in a certain sense, copied us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're doing it. And other universities, you know, have directors education. We let other universities even steal our name. All right? We said, look, you want to call it Directors College and run it someplace else? Fine.
Uh-huh.
Just go educate the directors. All right? We're not going to... We're playing this cooperatively, not competitively. You know, we've helped other universities start their directors, you know, education mm-hmm. programs. We believe in the mission. Let's go do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and fortunately, we've got the most successful program out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we work like banshees to make it work. We've got great people. I mean, Cy Lorne and Dan Siciliano absolutely spectacular. And one, you know, we've been at this 20 years. One of these years we're going to get it right. We'll figure it out. So we'll see what happens.
One of the governance issues that kind of pops up frequently in the 90s and in the 2000s is the proxy access issue. The SEC's sure. dealt with it a number of times. And part of that is the issue of nominating the directors and things like that. Can you tell me a little bit about your perspective, how that's developed as the SEC has pursued it?
Sure. You know, and again, I'm on the record. I have an article in Business Lawyer, so it's my views on this are transparent. There's a real simple logic to the process, and a lot of what the SEC has been talking about is profoundly illogical.
So let's
go to the basic premise. The basic premise is shareholders are smart enough to figure out if they want to vote for or against a director, and they're also smart enough to figure out if they want to nominate other people to run for the board. So every proponent of shareholder access has to believe that. Okay, and I go, okay, fine. Let's assume that's right. If that's right, then aren't the same shareholders smart enough to figure out the rules by which they want to have shareholder access? Aren't the shareholders smart enough to say, we want to have shareholder access with a trigger of 1%, 3%, 5%, 10%? We want shareholder access on an annual basis, on a biannual basis, on a So look, if the proposal is, let's have shareholders and boards work together to set up protocols for shareholder access at individual companies, including the possibility we're not going to allow shareholder access at all, I'm all for that. That's logically consistent. But here's my problem. How is it possible to say that the shareholders are smart enough to decide who should be on the board, but they can't be trusted to govern the process by which they make that decision?
Okay.
Now, I've never had a conversation with a person who can explain how you distinguish those two principles. And the problem with the mandatory shareholder access point of view is that it requires you to have two totally contradictory ideas, to hold two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. And that is, these people are smart enough to vote for directors, but they're not smart enough to set the rules by which they vote for directors. We have to tell them those rules. Hey, if you can't explain why these people aren't smart enough to set their own rules, but they're smart enough to vote for directors, that is fundamentally irrational. And that's the basic reason why I think these mandatory proxy access rules shouldn't pass the simple rationality standard under the APA. Okay? I mean, it's arbitrary and capricious, in my view, to say shareholders are smart enough to do this thing, but they're not smart enough to do that thing. We have to tell them how to do that. All right? That's my fundamental problem with it. Now, the D.C. Circuit had other problems in terms of the evidence and how you analyze the evidence, and I respect the point of view that maybe the D.C. Circuit didn't get its critique of what the SEC did correctly, correct on every point. I don't think they were wrong about everything. But, you know, even if you put that critique aside, I haven't heard anybody respond to my more fundamental problem with, you're asking me to hold two conflicting ideas in my head at the same time. And that's one of the definitions of arbitrary and capricious. It's internally inconsistent. And I just haven't had anybody. Can you explain it, Bob?
No, I can't.
Give it a shot. Like you say, this is the thing. And you know, the best response, you know, I've heard typically is, well, that's not the right way to think about the problem. I go, well, you know, sure. Because if you think about the problem that way, you're not going to get the answer you want. So, but you want the answer you want, and there you go.
So there's another issue in governance, and I would imagine that this has changed a great deal, is issues of board composition, issues of, and particularly the reforms that were called for the board in the wake of the Enron and other corporate accountability scandals. Can you tell me about how you saw those, what you saw as the issues at stake in the corporate accountability scandals, and then again with the reforms that were instituted for boards by the SEC and the exchanges?
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole situation, you've got to look at the complex surrounding, you know, Enron, WorldCom, sure. You know, a couple of other frauds, you know, mm-hmm. at the same time. And I think what it underscored is that there was a lot of room for improvement in the internal governance process over basic blocking and tackling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Sarbanes-Oxley response, I think, had a lot of good ideas, also had a lot of bad ideas in it. You know, like any complex piece of legislation, if you're going to go back and do it all over again, you would do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on balance, I think there was a lot of good. But it also caused a huge amount of money to be wasted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, some of the expenses around item 404, around 404,
mm-hmm.
just absolutely preposterous. And there's nothing wrong with 404. It's a delegation of authority to the mm-hmm. SEC and the PCAOB. But as soon as you saw what the rules coming out of the commission were, you know, my attitude is, this is crazy. Why don't we just make a pile of $100 bills, all right, and pour gasoline,
uh-huh.
and just light them on fire, okay?
Uh-huh.
Because this is mandating so much process
mm-hmm.
without any reason to think that it's actually going to solve the problem and make the world better,
mm-hmm.
all right? Billions of dollars were wasted, all right, in compliance with 404.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the SEC and the PCAOB got around to recognizing that they had made fundamental mistakes
mm-hmm.
in the way they wrote the implementing regulations, it was too late because you'd spent all the money and now you just had, you know, the annual maintenance costs of complying
mm-hmm.
with what was already in place, and there you go. So you know, there are large parts of Sarbanes-Oxley that terrific,
mm-hmm.
all right? You know, increasing the specialization of boards of directors mm-hmm. on audit committees, great.
Mm-hmm.
All right, getting more people involved on the board that really understand the finances of the company and that can intelligently ask probing questions and you know, getting the audit firms to up their game. I mean, all of this is absolutely fantastic,
mm-hmm.
but other items really went off the rails. You know, and 404 is an example where Congress didn't do anything wrong in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
It was the way the SEC and the PCAOB implemented it.
How so?
That they wrote the rules in an overly expansive manner.
Okay.
All right, that their definition of you know, material weakness and significant deficiency, you know, were so broad, and all of the tests that they in effect required, given the way the accounting firms were interpreting this,
mm-hmm.
you know, just led to massive expenditures of time and money,
okay.
for little or no improvement in the integrity of the reporting process.
Okay. I you may not be able to talk about, like, but you've served on public boards, and I was wondering,
sure.
I was wondering if you could talk a little about if you've seen changes in the way that they function.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I serve. So, I currently serve on the board of Financial Engines.
Mm-hmm.
That's a company that I actually co-founded,
okay.
17 years ago. So we're an overnight success. We're now publicly traded.
Mm-hmm.
We are today the largest registered investment advisor in the world.
Wow.
Right? As of our, you know, last quarterly announcement, we manage $70.8 billion. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's a terrific, you know, I love the people there. Our senior management team, we've had one CEO,
mm-hmm.
all right, for like 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
Average tenure of our senior management team is like 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
I jokingly say that, you know, it's because you guys are lousy. Nobody else in the Valley wants to hire you. It's because I think they're wonderful
uh-huh.
people and they've been doing a great job.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we've got a terrific board, I think. Extraordinarily competent. Really understands the market,
uh-huh.
Very active, always probing, always asking questions, always pushing management to do a better job. Management extraordinarily open, I think, with the board. I'm very happy with the way that runs. Then I'm also on the board at KKR, and you know that's obviously a very different situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there I'm chairman of the audit committee. That in effect is a controlled corporation because you know Henry and George, you know Henry Kravis and George Roberts, you know through an entity called Holdings, actually have the majority voting control. And you know if they wanted to fire all the independent directors and bring new ones, they could. All right. But they've been absolute princes. They say let's run this like it's forget about let's run this the right way. And they've got a terrific general counsel, and in every situation they've always taken the high road. And it's absolutely been a pleasure. And again, really competent people, serving on the board. They know what they're doing. I mean, the former CFO at Walmart, a former senior banker out of Morgan Stanley, Pat Russo, who's been a CEO, John Hess, it's an A-team, all right? And we all roll up our sleeves, Dieter Rampel, a banking executive from Europe. I mean, again, I've been very, very impressed, and it's been terrific that way.
Okay. Are there things that you've seen in, as you've served on these boards that are really, that you see as the critical elements of good governance by the boards?
Yeah, it's information.
Okay.
All right. You have to have a board that's smart enough to know what questions to ask, separate apart from anything that management wants to tell you.
Okay.
All right. If a board is always depending upon management for all of its information, you're dead. Okay. You then have no independent ability to ask questions. So, at KKR, every board member has lots of information networks, and we all have a tremendous amount of information that's relevant to, KKR, the private equity business. So we know how to question and probe, all right, I think, appropriately.
Yeah.
All right, what are we doing? What's our strategy? Which funds, are going out there? How are these funds performing? Do we need to shift resources from A to B? How is this initiative actually working? And we know more than what management is telling us. Same thing in financial engines.
Okay,
where, we've got a Harvard professor on the faculty. We've got another Stanford professor with me on the faculty. We've got CFOs from other companies. We've got the former CEO at Barclays. I mean, these are people who really know the space, and management can come in and say whatever it wants. We still got 50 questions based on things management hasn't told us. Okay? So having that kind of a really informed board, in my experience has really been terrific. As I look around corporate America, these are probably exceptions. I mean, if you look at how informed boards are, my guess is these two companies are top decile.
Okay.
All right? But that's where I'm comfortable playing.
So I wanted to ask, just we've talked a little bit about recent governance reforms, and some of the court decisions. Also, I was going to ask, what's your perspective on the, especially on the reforms coming out of Dodd-Frank, and then what do you see as the upcoming issues in corporate governance?
Well, Dodd-Frank, and again, this is a prediction I've been making ever since the day Dodd-Frank was enacted. I don't know what Dodd-Frank really is going to be. I don't know when Dodd-Frank is really going to be implemented. If you look at the statute, it's really a massive delegation of rulemaking authority to the SEC, CFTC, Department of Treasury, and the like. And we still don't know how these rules are going to work in many situations. We still don't have a Volcker rule. What's fascinating is we have investment banks changing their business strategy in anticipation of a rule that hasn't yet been written, which is one of the fascinating things. The threat of regulation is enough to cause real changes, okay? But we don't know what the swaps rules are going to look like. And to me, as soon as I read the Dodd-Frank, I said, there's no exemption in the Dodd-Frank Act from the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay.
Every rule that comes out of Dodd-Frank is going to be susceptible to legal challenge by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just think about the timing calculus and the incentive to challenge, I mean, many of these rules are interdependent. Mm-hmm. All right. Rule A depends on Rule B. What the SEC does rationally depends upon what the CFTC does. And, you know, you've got rationality tests and cost-benefit tests. Mm-hmm. You've got you've got all of these agencies working under the shadow of the Business Roundtable decision.
Mm-hmm.
So rules get passed. They then are challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here are the questions. Do the rules get stayed while the challenge goes forward?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, how long does it take the D.C. Circuit to rule on these matters?
Right.
It takes at least a year. All right. You know, more likely 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a stay
right.
of a rule once it's adopted, it's another 18 months before it goes into effect, assuming that the rule passes muster.
Uh-huh.
If the rule doesn't pass muster, you typically remand it to the agency and you say, do over. So, you know, what's the probability that all of these rules are going to pass muster?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily high, all right? And when they fail to pass muster, then what happens? So it's not immediately clear to me that Dodd-Frank is really going to take effect anytime soon.
Okay.
And it's also not clear to me that if you look at a rule that's adopted by one of the agencies, that that's the way the world is actually going to work in the future.
Okay. I wanted to leave a little bit of time for other topics that you'd like to talk about, if there's anything else that you'd like to talk about.
Oh, no. I'm the luckiest bastard you'll ever run across. Okay. There you go.
Okay. I did want to. So in 2006, you want to tell me a little about the Rock Center for Governance?
Oh, yeah, no. Rock Center, absolutely terrific. Arthur Rock and Tony Remby Rock, they've been coming to several of the programs we've been doing at the university,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially our Director's College program.
Mm-hmm.
And they apparently were very big fans.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur calls me up one day and he says, I'd like to give you $10 million. Right, yeah, I know. Right, I know. And I kind of go, excuse me, is this a wrong number, Arthur? He says, no. He goes, I love what you guys at Stanford have been doing about corporate governance because you're doing research and you're in the real world at the same time.
Uh-huh.
You're not writing, you know, these airy flights of fantasy that aren't connected to reality.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to figure out what's the smart, right way
mm-hmm.
to do this? How do we balance all of these issues? You know, and you know, there's a certain style that's associated.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that the style of what we do here at Stanford is simultaneously intellectually very rigorous, deeply rigorous,
mm-hmm.
and useful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Sure.
And that's a style that Arthur appreciates.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And he said, well, come up with a proposal for what you would do
uh-huh.
if you know, I actually gave you the $10 million.
Right.
And here we are.
Okay.
You know, and Arthur and Tony have just been absolutely terrific. And, you know, the gift, you know, we're very entrepreneurial here at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
We've used that gift to generate other sources of income. So basically we've grown that
sure.
$10 million. All right, so that, you know, it's you know, one of the mistakes that I think many organizations make is they say, okay, here's $10 million, let's spend it down, and let's go raise another $10
million. Uh-huh.
My view is, here's $10 million, let's turn it into 30,
yeah.
okay,
right.
and do good things with the 30. So that's basically what we're doing.
Okay. One of the projects I saw discussed is analyzing the governance metrics.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little?
Yeah, that's Dave Larker.
Okay.
Basically, he's looked at all of the metrics that places like ISS and other
uh-huh.
organizations generate, and he's in effect demonstrated that they don't tell you anything useful. All right.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, you have all of these governance scores, and, you know, if you try to invest based on these governance scores, you're not going to do well.
Uh-huh.
That if you look at the governance scores across different agents, across different ratings organizations, they rarely agree.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that the amount of disagreement is really extraordinarily large,
mm-hmm.
And that there's no systematic reason to think that these groups, you know, in Dave's view,
mm-hmm.
know what they're doing. So needless to say, this makes Dave and the Rock Center less than popular, mm-hmm. all right, with the proxy advisory community. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, this is the great thing. If you approach these questions with intellectual integrity, mm-hmm. and you say, look, you can disagree with us, but we're not cooking the books. We think we're asking the questions reasonably. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, if it's clear what's good corporate governance and what's bad corporate governance, why do you advisors disagree so much? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a tough question for them to answer. Yeah. All right, it's a simple question, but it's and you know, we went through a rocky phase, but now they understand that listening to our critique is actually good for them. Mm-hmm. So Directors College this year, our Monday morning breakfast, we have the CEO of ISS. Mm-hmm. All right, he's going to be here, and Larker's going to be here, and we're going to engage. And mm-hmm. he knows he can't ignore the questions right. we're asking. And if we ask them honestly and rigorously, without mm-hmm. a political agenda, mm-hmm. all right, he's going to engage. Mm-hmm. And we're going to engage with him. We can't be in the business of doing research that makes people comfortable.
Right.
That's not what we do. We've got to be intellectually rigorous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we've got issues about what management's doing, we'll write that up. All right. If we've got issues about what shareholders are doing, we'll write that up. Mm-hmm. You know, there are pieces that we've written that some people think are, you know, pro-shareholder. There are other pieces that we've written that people think are, you know, pro-management. Our view is, look, tell us what's wrong intellectually with any of these pieces, mm-hmm. and we'll listen to you. Now, you don't like the conclusion, that's not going to move my meter.
Right.
You don't like the reasoning, you got my attention. Right. Right. That's the way we look at it.
Okay.
You know, you can't do work in this area without pissing somebody off. Right. If you try to make everybody happy, you're never going to say anything useful.
Right. That pretty much covers everything I'd like to ask, unless there's anything else.
No, that's great. Okay. We covered much more real estate than I thought we would.
Great.